用声音碰撞世界，
生动活泼。
各位听友大家好，欢迎来到这一期的科技早知道，我是杜晨。今天我们节目的嘉宾呢，如你已经在标题里看到的，正是科技作家凯文·凯利先生。
My name is Kevin Kelly。
如果你对他并不熟悉的话，在这里我做一个简短的介绍。凯文·凯利是一位极具影响力的科技作家和未来学家，作品涵盖了多个领域。他是连线杂志的创始编辑，带领杂志成为了全球最有影响力的科技刊物之一。除此之外呢，凯文·凯利更为人熟知的身份是畅销书作家和未来学家。他的著作如《失控》以及《必然》等等，深入探讨了科技对社会和人类的影响，并且也引发了许多关于科技伦理和社会变革的思考。他的著作对许多你可能更加熟悉的科幻作品都提供了巨大的启发，其中最著名的呢，莫过于《黑客帝国》三部曲。
The Matrix is a computer-generated dream。
在过去呢，凯利的很多知名作品都是大部头，但是这一次他带着一本可以说非常言简意赅的新书来到了中国。宝贵的人生建议是这本书的名字，里边有500条由他亲笔撰写的给这个世界留下的忠告。然而在跟他交流之后，我却发现写作这件事情对于他来说并没有变得越来越省事，因为越短小精悍的文字越需要清晰的头脑和剪辑。他在这本书里尝试了一种全新的写法，犹如创作诗歌一般。他把这些人生忠告比作种子，每一颗都足够小巧，但可以生根发芽，长出一棵参天大树。在九月中旬的上海，凯文·凯利做客科技早知道播客节目。在本期当中，你会听到他为什么不太喜欢未来学家的这个身份。
Almost every single prediction about the future will be wrong。
他为什么觉得 AI 的影响被低估，但机器学习技术却被高估了。
If they imitate it so well, then what's the difference?
他为什么鼓励我们所有人这一辈子都要尽全力不成为亿万富翁。
Try as hard as you can to never have $1 billion。
以及他对马斯克的忠告。
My advice to Elon is very simple, is get off.
节目的语言将为英语。好的，那么接下来让我们进入节目正片。
Mr. Kelly, welcome to the podcast. I am personally a big fan of your work, and I'm sure lots of our listeners are too. But just in case some of our listeners aren't that familiar with you, would you care to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you for having me. My name is Kevin Kelly. I am a co-founder of Wired Magazine, which is about the culture of technology. And I've been the author of several books,trying to think about what technology means to us and where it might go. And I recently wrote a book, The Next 5,000 Days, which is about what's next.
That's amazing. So welcome to Shanghai and welcome to the show. I believe the last time you were here, was it in 2016?
In Shanghai, probably.
Mm-hmm, right. So back then you laid out some possible options for Shanghai in terms of which technologythey can develop and what industry consolidation to work on. For example, you mentioned that you could work on artificial intelligence or maybe virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
From what I could tell, this city and its surrounding area has been, you know, putting much effort in the transformation of the automotive industry, for instance. Many public roads have been designated as high-level autonomous driving test zones.And they are being utilized by lots of local self-driving companies, so on and so forth. So I wonder what's your thought on Shanghai's development for technology since the last time you were here and about China in general?
I haven't been in China for 4 years, so I feel very much out of sync with what's happening here. And that's one of the reasons why I'm back, is to kind of learn as much as I can. And I've said for a while, I think,China is poised in its own development to generate a widely, universally desired consumer device that's the highest quality design and technology. And I thought that it would be something like an electric car or a self-driving car, maybe. But everything about China's capabilities and its own interest in AI, I thought that that was a really good conjunction of a practical, implemented, deployed technology at scale. And so whether it happens in Shanghai or not, I don't know enough about China's own internal industry. But I do think that I can easily imagine an iPhone equivalent of an electric car that everybody in the world wants, made here and is exported worldwide.
So you have been recognized in China as a tech visionary, a futurist. I'm sure people ask you all the time questions like, what's your take on the future? What's your prediction, etc. But I know you personally don't like to use the term futurist to describe yourself. Specifically, I listened to Steve Dubner of the Freakonomics Radio interviewing you, and you said most of what we're doing is trying to predict the present. So my questions are, why do you say that? What does predicting the present exactly mean? And how would you, that is, if you would like to, set the record straight once and for all that you are not a futurist, you are not even trying to predict the future? Yeah.
So I don't call myself the futurist because I know that almost every single prediction about the future will be wrong. But you can be productively wrong. So I will talk about the future knowing that I'm wrong, but even though that wrong, that idea of it can still be productive. It still can be useful. So even if you have a vision of the future that's not correct, the fact that you had a vision that was positive can still be helpful. So I will continue to talk about the future, and in that sense, I guess I'm a futurist, but I'm not a futurist in trying to predict where things are going. I'm trying to be useful in helping people prepare for the future. And as I said, the difficult part is really predicting the present. And by that, I mean just literally being able to see what is going on right now. So I spend a lot of time with AI, and part of it is to understand exactly what is happening with AI, not in the abstract sense, not in what the press releases say, but how do people actually use them? How does it actually change their job? How does it change about how they think about themselves? What actually is the present? If I can get a better look at what is happening, it makes it easier to think about the future. And part of thinking about the future is that we have assumptions. We have stories and pictures in our own mind. And it's very hard to let go of those prejudices. And so if we think about robots, we have pictures of the Terminator. We have pictures of Star Wars. We think we know what robots are. But part of my attempt is to try to forget those pictures and say, well, what do we have right now here? And then let's think about the future.
So on the topic of AI, this is at least one prediction that you made about the future. So earlier this year with Noah Smith, you said that artificial intelligence is quote unquote underhyped and will be arguing, discussing and wrangling with the changes brought about by AI for the next decades, largely because its full effects on human society will take centuries to play out. I agree with that, but people like us, we think in terms of 5 to 10 years at most.
Sure.
And some of us are already like scared about the possibility that us having to compete with AI in the future. And on that note, however, you are of the opinion that machine learning is overhyped and it's not sentient, at least at this stage.
Sure.
So my questions are, since we're talking about giving advice today, what advice would you give to people who fear that the AI has already come and that human race is doomed, whatever?
Cleanest, clearest, quickest cure, remedy for belief that AI will take over is to use it every day. You'll very quickly understand that today's technology is nowhere close to replacing you. Now, the question is, well, where could it go in the future? Well, that's a different question. I think it's not going to move as fast as people think. But if you start with what we have today, there's no fear. You will not have fear if you start using it every day. And the people that I find that are most afraid are really people who are not using it all the time. If you use it all the time, you realize that there's huge differences between the way that it thinks and the way that we think. And we're still figuring out what those differences are. The way I like to describe the current batch of AIs in the world, the large language models, the ones that are making all the news right now. They're not the only way to do AI, but they're the ones that are now the most popular and they've shocked us the most. And the thing about the men is, and many people will say, is that they're built to predict the next word. Well, that's true, but that's not the only thing they're doing. So the big transition is that they are predicting patterns. They're imitating humans, okay? So that's what they're good at. And it turns out that language not only has a pattern of language, not in a sentence, but if you take a paragraph, there is intelligence built into most paragraphs. If you take a book, that book will be making an argument or something that seems very intelligent. So the language models, the AIs, can imitate the logic of humans. We say they're imitating genius. And so these are able to imitate the genius of a paragraph, the genius of a book that actually has intelligence in it. And so we can say, well, they're not really intelligent because they're just imitating it. But if they imitate it so well, then what's the difference? The question is, most of what they're imitating a certain kind of intelligence that we find in books, in pictures, in writing. That's not the only kind of intelligence that we have. We do other things. We behave in other ways that's not captured by language. And that's kind of what's missing so far. So they can do kind of a bookish intelligence. They can do analogies, they can do simulations, they can do lots of things that we could find reflected in language. But we are more than just language. So that's what we have so far. What we have so far are AIs that can imitate the intelligence that we find in a language where we can make a logical deduction, we can make an inference, we can make an analogy. All those are found in what we write. And so it's imitating that. And so that's very powerful. We don't know yet what we can do with it, and we don't know what we can't do with it. But it's very clear that what we do is more than just that. But nonetheless, that's still a very powerful thing. I mean, that's incredibly powerful if we can have the intelligence of a book that's like, wow. And so we're kind of exploring right now for the next 5 years, how far can we go with that kind of imitating genius? And everybody will have access to one. And it's like, what can you do if you have a million little geniuses? And the answer is probably a lot, but not everything.
Exactly. You mentioned earlier that you are using AI every day, right? Would you like to tell us, like, how have you been using them, and how do you find them useful to you?
Sure. I use one set to do art. I co-create art with them. And a lot of people, again, who were afraid of it, they thought, oh, it's going to be like you just push a button and they make the art. No, it doesn't work that way. It's a little bit like photography. When photography and cameras first came along, the painters thought, oh, they just pushed a button. That's not art. Well, anybody who knows a great photographer is that they'll take hundreds of pictures. They can take a picture better than you because they are moving through it. They're picking the right perspective, the right lighting. There's a lot going on to just clicking the button. And the same thing with AI art is I will spend half hour, an hour working on a picture, going through iterations and asking it. And like a little bit like photography, I'm hunting, I'm looking for the right prompt, the right perspective. So it takes a lot of time, and it's not just clicking a button, it's actually co-creating. I'm very confident and very comfortable putting my name with the AI. And so I'm making the art, and then on the language models, what it's good for is summaries, taking lots of things and summarizing them and categorizing it, kind of logically structuring things. And the more weird and hard for us to kind of download it, the more powerful they are. And they're good for going into places where I don't know anything. And it's really good at being kind of creative of doing something I could do, but would be so time consuming, like to take two different fields and mash them together. That's something I could do, but man, it would just take me weeks to do it. And they can do it in seconds. So that kind of a summary, a distillation, an abstracting is really good. It is really good at synthesizing things that are in between.
Yeah, those things that do not exist.
That do not overlap, right, normally. And they will overlap things that don't normally overlap, so you can write something in the style of poetry or rap, that kind of a thing, or write in the style of somebody. You just say, you know, I want to put this in bullets, or put this in a poem, or put this in a rap song, or put it in a PowerPoint presentation. So it's really, really, really good at that. And the third way is in idea generation. Most of the ideas will be cliche, but occasionally there are ideas that I had not thought of that I thought were brilliant. And so you cannot use these things by themselves. They're interns. You have to make them your own. You have to rewrite them. They're not something you can just take off the shelf that they provide. So there's always a co-creation aspect to this. And so I use this to help generate ideas for whatever it is I'm doing.
Cool. I mean, I personally find even some of the creations of those AI are cliche. I find them useful. I find them, you know, they can be used in circumstances where cliche is basically enough. For example, when we are having to deal with sometimes clients and we have to give them ideas, sometimes they will even go with the most cliche one.
Sure, sure. We could take our conversation we just had so far and you could ask the chat to summarize 5 bullet points from it. Now, that is something that you and I could do, but it'll take us an hour to do it well. And this will do it in seconds. And it'll do a pretty good job. You're not looking for genius at that point. You're just looking for something that's average and adequate, and that's all that you need. And so there's a lot of chores like that where just having the median average intern thing is good enough for what we're trying to do.
The topics on artificial intelligence is really fascinating. I would love to, you know, have 3 hours to discuss that with you. But today we're on the more important topic of the book. I have been blessed by you and the publishing house in China to have an advanced copy of your upcoming book, Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier. So I believe around 2020, you had somewhere around 68 pieces of advice. And last year, you had over 100. But in this book, you have as many as 500, particularly for the version in China. What's the cause of this sudden inflation? And is it ever going to stop?
Well, that's a really good question. Because I am not a person that normally gave advice. Even I have 3 children who are all young adults now. And they can tell you that we do not have a lot of advice, particular expression of advice. But I have been collecting little bits of advice that I kind of wrote down over time. Some of them I really did wish I'd known earlier. And so I decided that I should write these down and give them to my kids so that they would see them when they were younger. And so I began writing them down, and I was surprised because once I started doing it, I had a lot to say. And part of it is, as a writer, I enjoy the challenge of trying to reduce them a whole book of advice down to one little sentence. And so I really worked on putting them into my own words in as few words as possible to really make them like a tweet, like something you'd find on Weibo, a really easily transmittable and memorable little line. And so that was the joy. And I am still, even though we have 500 in the book, I actually am still writing more. And so for me, the criteria for the inclusions of these little, they're all, for those who haven't seen it, it's a book that has 500 little bits, little one line, two line, maybe 3 lines at the most, a little tweet that's a bit of advice. And that's the entire book. So it's sort of like the Bible without any stories. It's just the advice part. The criteria for including a little bit is one is I had to really stand by it. It's genuinely something that I believed to be helpful and had personal experience with. So something that was true to me. And secondly, it had to be short and memorable. And thirdly, I wanted it to be helpful and positive, uplifting rather than sarcastic. And so those three things are what unify it. And I find that I'm still trying to distill a complicated idea into a few words as possible that would be helpful to someone to repeat to themselves.
That is exactly the next question I wanted to ask you. As a former writer, I still write from time to time. And as a writer, as a former journalist, I personally suffer from the curse that is the imposter syndrome. I constantly fear that my writings may not be good enough to warrant people's time. So the questions are, what prompted you to write these pieces of advice and later on decided to publish them as a book? And during that process, did you ever fear that these pieces might not be good or distinct enough?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, the imposter syndrome is this feeling that people who are making that they don't deserve to be saying things, or they don't deserve any of the recognition that they might get, that they're kind of impostering, they're faking it. It's a real thing. And by the way, many, many celebrities still feel that way. Even though they, by any measure, have succeeded, it's something that for some people doesn't go away. They have to kind of confront it. So for me, that's not been a problem. I feel that the only permission that you need is to be authentic about what it is that you're saying, to be sure you're not just repeating what sounds good or what other people have said. That if you're authentic, that's all that I need to be comfortable in giving my advice. I don't have to be an expert. I don't have to have a title. I don't have to have a million followers. I just have to be authentic and say, this is true for me. And that's all that anybody, I believe, needs. And so my advice then for the people who feel that is that if you are really working to make it something that only you can say or do, that's coming from you and is not imitating it, then you are the ordained. You are the God. And so you don't need to feel an imposter because you're not posing as somebody. That's imposter. You're posing. If you're not posing, then you don't need to have that feeling.
So let's dive into the book. Yeah. On the topic of giving advice, you wrote on page 201, I believe, on the Chinese version, that the best way to advise young people is to find out what they really want to do and then advise them to do it. So we're in a world that is as diverse as possible, and there are endless types of people with different ideas, beliefs, goals, etc., etc. And I personally find that conflicts can happen between two people, even if one of them is only trying to be helpful and give advice. So how can we be certain that we give actual useful advice to other people, especially to the young people of today? And what is the best way to give these advice without sounding, you know, condescending or causing other types of, you know, antipathy?
Yeah, it's a good question. My solution, my remedy is, the most powerful thing you can do is to tell your story with real honesty. It's impossible for me not to be who I am, but I can try and be as absolutely honest and authentic and original as I can. And that's the only thing. And so my advice is putting a hat on. If it's not useful, you should ignore it. You're certainly not obligated to follow anybody's advice. You should only follow advice if you find it useful at the time. And that's the thing about advice, is that you may hear it when you're young and it may not even register. You may have to get older to appreciate it. You may have to hear it more than once. And so I often call them reminders. You have to be reminded. I wrote them down to help me remind myself.
On page 3, you wrote that being enthusiastic is worth 25 IQ points. And you also wrote on another page, I believe, that the world is defined by optimists. Is being optimistic the secret sauce for you to become and remain thoughtful and wise? Is optimism the major divider between average people and people who go on to change the world?
Yeah, those are kind of maybe two different things. Enthusiasm and optimism aren't the same, but enthusiasm for me in my own life, when I'm hiring, I am much more likely to hire someone who is very enthusiastic versus very, very, very smart. And so enthusiasm is literally often more valuable than just being smart. People who are smart tend to overrate the value of smartness. And that's one of the reasons why we have difficulty imagining the future of AI. Because it turns out that smartness is not the only thing that you need to get things done in the world. You need other things. You need grit. You need perseverance. You need imagination. Many, many other things just besides smartness. It's not the smartest person that does all the great things. It's not the smartest company wins the unicorn. It's, in fact, sometimes smartness can be a handicap. And so you need lots of other things besides IQ. Enthusiasm is one of those things that it's about commitment, encouragement, a drive to and backing. It's kind of a little bit of a loyalty. There's a lots of things about enthusiasm. Part of it is positivity. It's like saying you are going to try and make things happen. And then positivity, optimism, is also one of those qualities just as valuable as intelligence. You've probably never met a very, very successful pessimistic person. Very, very rare. You have to be optimistic in some ways to have success at a high level, because part of optimism is seeing a future and making it happen and believing that it could happen. That belief is very, very important, because you're not going to work 80 hours a week in something you don't believe is possible. That belief is optimism. And so our world has been created by past optimists. The people who believe that this railway could happen, people who believe that this vaccine would work, people who believed that, you know, we could go to the moon. And so that means that in the future, our future world is going to be created by people who are optimistic today. So I think the value of being an optimist is tremendous.
How can we be optimistic when the world is kind of going crazy? The sudden explosion of artificial intelligence, and particularly chatbots powered by large language models, are seen in the relevant industry as the next big thing. But overall speaking, this only further added fuel to the fear that AI is taking over more and more jobs. And the economy here is pretty bad these days, and particularly the employment rate these days are so bad. Can being optimistic shepherd us through this economic downturn?
Sure. I think it can. And I find there's a couple of things that help me maintain my optimism. Actually, not maintain it. I am more optimistic today than I was yesterday. So I believe optimism is not an emotional state. It's a deliberate choice. You choose to be optimistic. And we can choose to be as optimistic as you possibly can now. What helps me is reading history. The more history you read, the clearer it is that progress is real and that the past is not a place that you want to live in. Yeah. So as bad as it may seem right now, it's not as bad as it's been. We will, on average, make things a little better. Of course, there are parts of the world like Ukraine and other places where you have a healthy body. Even a healthy body will have some areas that have cuts and bruises, and you want to recover from those as fast as possible. But on average, we can be optimistic because we are in a world where we can improve a little tiny bit. And so the other thing that helps you be optimistic is to realize that those improvements are almost not visible. They're just a few percentages. But they're compounded. So you can be optimistic because you understand the value of compounding. 1% compounded every year over 30 years. It's incredible. So there's two things: the longer view of the past, understanding history, and taking a longer view of the future. the higher and longer your view is, the more optimistic you can become. And so I am optimistic because I take a long view. I try to think about a generation or two. And there, the fact that you have only a small accumulation of a few percent better, but it's accumulated over decades, that's incredibly powerful. And that is where our optimism comes from.
On the internet, people just can't stop sharing their opinions on anything. Sometimes they do in a very aggressive manner. I believe you wrote on one page that you don't have to attend every argument you are invited to. The questions are, how do we resist the urge to argue with other people? And to follow up on that question, how do we popularize the idea that it is okay to have different opinions, that arguing meaninglessly is such a waste of time and energy for the society as a whole?
Most arguments are not about the thing that's being argued about. And most people's opinions on things are not come from reasoning and logical. So you can't use reason or logic to undo them. You actually need a more emotional thing. If you want to change someone's people mind, actually, I found the most useful thing is to try and understand what it is and why they believe something. And you're much more likely to change their mind if you can come to some understanding of how they got there. It's not about logic or anything cerebral. It's people absorb a lot of their views without even thinking about them. And so they can't unthink them. So that would say one thing is your likelihood of you changing someone's mind by arguing is very, very, very low. And that's one reason why you don't want to attend to them. And I find that you can actually affect more change in people by changing yourself. For me, the most powerful way to criticize something is to make something else. It's not even, don't even try and tear down the thing they have. Just make something better, whatever it is. And I find myself in the social medias that I just don't follow people who are outraged. I much rather follow someone who is building something or making something or has a positive solution. But to me, outrage is just like the cheapest. It's like sex. It's like, yes, it's very base. It's very fundamental and cheap.
On page 60, you wrote, and I am personally fascinated by this, the worst evil is committed by those who truly believe they are combating evil. I wonder, what's the source of this piece of advice? More specifically, I wonder if you wrote this piece with some of the most brilliant tech founders in mind.
No, I had in mind things like the Nazis. In the US, the people who promoted slavery, they were very religious people. They believed they were doing good. 9/11, the jihad, Islamic people, they believed they were doing the work of God. They were eliminating evil in the world, and they were willing to do those kinds of things. And so my advice is that if you are trying to eliminate evil, be very, very careful, because if you're trying to eliminate evil, there's a chance that you could be tempted to do heinous, evil things.
So let me rephrase my question. On the tech internet side of that question is, do you have any advice for tech founders, internet company founders these days that are saying they are changing the world for the better, but however, years later, you find them fought the dragon for too long and became the dragon itself?
Yeah, I know a lot of these founders and have been watched them through. I think their belief in trying to do good is genuine. When you have power, it's easy to corrupt. Somewhere else in the book, I said that, you know, the real test of character is not adversity, it's power. It's really, really hard to have power without it corrupting you. People who start out believing they're doing well, they often come up with this idea of, you know, the means justifying the ends. It's like, yes, they're going to do some things. They're making trade-offs, and so sometimes the trade-offs they make are reasonable at the time and they look terrible in retrospect. That's something else that happens, is that today we would be very, very hard on things that were done in the past. But at the time in the past, they were more accepted. And so it's hard to judge people in the past to our standards because we believe things today. you and I that are going to be embarrassing to people in the future. I don't know what they are, but I know that there's some of my beliefs, maybe like eating meat, right? I mean, in 1,000 years from now, whatever, people will be horrified that you had to kill a pig and eat the flesh of the pig. They'll see that as completely barbaric. Well, I'm just using that as an example of things that we could be doing today that will be seen in a very, very poor light in the future. So we can't really judge all the time from the view of where we are in the past. So I think in terms of tech founders, I applaud their desire to try and do good. I think they deserve whatever feedback the press gives them, whatever accountability, it makes them uncomfortable, but they're better for it. And so that's, to me, the solution is just to continue to look at them closely and hold them accountable. Of course, lots of people are things that they criticize people for, and they're going to ignore some of it, and some of it should be ignored. You know, there's kind of a too politically correct. I'm not really harsh on the tech founders. I think it's a tough position to be in.
Yeah, at least they are building something.
Yes, and so if you're criticizing, the best way to criticize is make your own unicorn.
The last piece of advice I want to talk about. On page 5, you wrote that we shouldn't be afraid to ask stupid questions. As someone who used to ask questions and quote other people for being myself, I echo with this a lot. Can you give me one example of a stupid question? What's one stupid question that you have asked recently to anybody or to yourself?
Yeah, as I said, I don't really think there are stupid questions. You kind of want to ask the question that you're thinking of. And it may seem stupid because you think, well, everybody knows the answer to this. But I don't know what the answer is, so I'm going to ask. So I have heard a lot about AI or something, and I'm going to go in and someone's, like you say, there's a CEO and they're saying, and they're using all kind of jargon. I feel perfectly fine saying, explain that to me. I don't get this TPS thing. What is that? And so that's what I meant by a stupid question, where it's a genuine question. You're generally confused, but you shouldn't be embarrassed that you don't know. Don't be embarrassed by your own ignorance.
Right. I want to move on to a part where, as a writer, I want to discuss with you topics on writing itself. Sure. So you have been writing for decades about technology, about human society, and I say on behalf of many of your readers in China that we love your writing for the complexity demonstrated. And now you come out with this new book, which is as short as it gets when it comes to writing. So the questions are, how difficult is it to write concisely while conveying as much as possible? And what advice can you give to aspiring writers about writing concisely?
Yes, so this is a book that has 450 sentences, we'll say, or 500 sentences. It's really, really short. And it's very telegraphic. I use the word telegraph. It really kind of compresses a lot. It's almost poetic in that sense. In fact, my other writing is also telegraphic. I am packing in a lot using that telegraphy. The writing styles are very, very similar in a certain sense. It's just that the ambition or the scale of what I'm trying to do is much smaller in this book. And so this was, in a certain sense, a continuation of my style by just to remove any need to tell any kind of a story at all. And just, I'm just going to give you the punchline. I'm just going to give you the takeaway.
And I find it very interesting that you compare these pieces of advice in the books as seeds, that each of them can be sort of sold and grown into a full-length piece on the topic. Correct me if I'm wrong. There are writings that are just short and do the job versus writings that are not only concise, but also they are like seeds. They can grow into something. They inspire readers to think beyond the content. Is there a difference deep down between writers and editors just, you know, deleting words from the article versus carefully peeling the fruit and revealing the seed? Is there a difference deep down between?
I think there is a difference. Even in my nonfiction writing and when I was editing Wired, what we really try to do was to remove all unnecessary words because people have a short attention span and the smaller things are, the easier they are to consume. So you want things to be as small as possible. There's also a beauty in words. Sometimes require length, so there's a balancing thing. To say something in a very lyrical way can help you remember it. So there are competing different factors in trying to edit something. It's not only the shortest version. You want the clearest version. You want the version that's most memorable. So there's lots of competing things. And so I don't know if there's a huge difference between removing everything and then trying to have it as a seed. The seed thing, I think, is closer to what poetry tries to do. Poetry is sort of evoking. It doesn't want to say things. It wants you to say it in your mind. Kind of. It wants to evoke, suggest, hint at something, and then have you fill it in. So I think this book is a little closer to that in the sense of, oh, it's going to say something that might remind you of something that you begin to fill in that seed sense of growing, where you are kind of doing more of the work. And that's one of the reasons why poetry is harder to read, because you're having to work a little bit. You've got to make up the answer. This book may be a little closer to that in the sense that people tell me that they read 2 pages and that's all they can read. They have to think about it, or they don't want to read. I mean, they could, but they want to kind of take their time to contemplate it, to unpack it, because this is a little bit like poetry in the sense that you are kind of bringing to it the completion of it, and you're completing it in your mind.
Would you suggest a right way to read this book, like yes. Maybe 1-2 pages per day?
Yes. In fact, originally it was going to be 1 a day. On my treat stream, I release 1 a day. And we talked about an app that did 1 a day. So I think, in fact, the best way is to read 1 a day.
The next question. From whom do you seek advice?
Yes.
Describe who they are, what they're like, and tell us how do we go about finding people like them to get advice from?
Sure, sure. That's a good question. And I was very fortunate to have some mentors and people that I worked with who I respected tremendously and admired. I always valued wisdom over intelligence. And I always was seeking out those who were wise. It wasn't so much things that they said that I was copying down. It was the life that they were living and the priorities they had and the way they made the trade-offs and the decisions that they made and the process they had it. Those are what impressed me. And of course, as I said elsewhere, I think part of wisdom is having a longer view. And so these are people who are involved in the Long Now Foundation, and they had a long view, and that long view, I think, helps you make you wise.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sort of my last or second last question. The world is rapidly changing. I wonder if you are worried about anything or anyone in particular. For example, for me, one person I'm worried about is Elon Musk. He's changing the world for the better and the worse at the same time. And I'm worried that he's becoming an idol for so many people, particularly his arrogant, inconsiderate side. If I were to give him an advice, I would want him to be a nicer person, but I know lots of people are telling him that at the end of a line. If you were to meet a leader of this world, of any domain, tech, government, whatever, and give them a piece of advice, which person would you choose and what would you tell them?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, I guess I'd have to believe that my advice might make a difference. So who is more susceptible? Putin, Elon, Jeff Bezos. My advice to Elon is very simple, is get off Twitter. If he was only not on Twitter, just like completely 100%, don't let them tell Twitter, don't let me back on, no matter what I say, never let me back on. If he was off Twitter, half of his problems would be solved. So I was around some billionaires, and I was telling them, I'm the richest guy here. I don't have anywhere a billion or even 100 million. I don't have anything, but I'm the richest guy here because I have total control of my time. I don't have $1 billion. And that's one of the things I tell young listeners is like, if my advice to you, try as hard as you can to never have $1 billion. You do not want $1 billion. $1 billion is terrible for your kids. It'll be a full-time job. You never get rid of it. You can't spend it. It'll just keep coming back. You are now chained to that $1 billion. That's the dilemma that the very super rich have, is that they have all these obligations because of their wealth. And they don't have total control of their time. I have free time. They don't have free time. Time is the most precious thing. And so I feel wealthier than they do. They're kind of stuck because this $1 billion owns them in some ways. Money is a means to get other things, but it's not something you actually want in the end, and because you're not going to take it with you. So try to have your own definition of success that doesn't involve money very much. Don't rely on other people's definition of success, because then you can be more authentic. It's more likely to come down to something that you and your own talents and your own experience can do. You don't want to be an influencer or celebrity that's already occupied. There are a lot of people there already.
Yeah.
You want to have something, be doing something that nobody has a name for. That's really hard to describe to someone what it is that you're doing. It's kind of like 15 years ago, if you told people, yeah, I'm doing something that's like radio, but not. Yeah. It's called a podcast. And people say, what's that? I never heard of that. You want to have your own be in your own movie. You don't want to be in someone else's movie. And a lot of people are shooting like Elon Musk. They want to be Elon Musk. No, you don't. They're already doing that. That's occupied. You want to be a category of one where you are not the best, but the only.
From writing about the creativity of mankind, predicting how technology evolves, to giving young people sage advice, which might be interpreted as one of the low-hanging fruits when it comes to writing a book. I wonder, what about Kevin Kelly has changed and what hasn't? You mentioned earlier that you are writing another book. Are you still continuing your good work in thinking and writing about technology, predicting the present, besides packaging your life's experience as advice?
Yes, I am. My current project is called The 100-Year Desirable Future. And I'm trying to make scenarios, not predictions, but scenarios for a future in 100 years is filled with AI and genetic engineering and monitoring that I want to live in. That's not dystopia, that's actually protopia. That's my current project. And it's looking at 100 different verticals like sports and fashion and food and stuff. I think one of the things that's changed in recent years is my commitment to become even more optimistic than I have been, to make it, again, a deliberate choice to become radically optimistic. When I was in high school, I was trying to decide whether to go to art school or science, and I decided to go to science, but I think I might have been happier going to art. Intelligence is overrated. If you put Einstein and a tiger in a cage, who wins? Not the smartest. So smartness is not the only thing we need. And I think the kinds of things that art are doing are necessary for us. And as the AI does more of the intelligence stuff, I think we humans, find ways to amplify the other qualities that humans have besides intelligence. And so that's sort of what I am thinking of these days, is what else besides IQ, what else besides intelligence is necessary for us?
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. It has been a wonderful experience speaking with you, getting all my questions answered. Some of them might have been stupid questions. I'm not sure, but it's really a great experience talking with you. Thank you so much. And I would highly encourage our listeners to get Mr. Kelly's upcoming book, Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier. All right. Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being here. You didn't ask stupid questions. For me, a real joy is to be asked questions that haven't been asked before. Mm-hmm. And you asked some of those. So that makes it a pleasure for me. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Thank you, sir.
以上就是本期科技早知道节目的全部内容。 如果你对我们这次全英文节目的尝试有建议或意见的话，欢迎通过小宇宙留言、电子邮箱等各种渠道方式提交。在节目上线一段时间之后，我们也会提供中文翻译稿件。感谢你的收听，并且如果你身在国内的话，祝你假期快乐。我是杜晨，我们下期再见。
这期 What's Next 科技早知道就到这里了。听完之后，如果你有任何的想法，欢迎在评论区里面给我们留言，我们每一条都会认真的看。如果你喜欢我们的节目，请记得给我们五星或者好评，分享给更多的朋友，也会对我们非常有帮助。你也可以单独写邮件给我，邮箱地址是ting@sheng.fm， 我都会一一回复。那同时公众号和微博也可以搜索生动活泼，声是声音的声，节目相关的更多信息会在公众号里出现，微博和公众号都会有不定期的福利给到大家。如果你想要跟我们更加紧密的讨论和分享，或者是想要认识和你一样有求知欲的新朋友，可以加入我们的微信群。进入听众群的方法是在公众号文章中扫码添加，或者是公众号后台回复科技早知道即可获取邀请码。期待你的加入，我们下期见。